This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Congress and the budget, Medicaid, food stamps, and other social programs face cuts. I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In Washington, budget cutting is underway. The traditional targets of conservatives, entitlement programs, are facing major cuts. But how big a dent in the federal deficit will taking a few hundred thousand people off food stamps make? And how deep can Republicans cut before it starts to hurt their electoral prospects in 2006? On Reporter's Notebook, the Iraqi government has called for some officers in the disbanded Iraqi army to come back to service. A good practical move or a desperate measure to help fight the insurgency? That's coming up on To the Point. First, this news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. On today's show, as both houses of Congress get down to nuts and bolts work on the budget, we'll be talking about programs under threat. And later, on Reporter's Notebook, the interim government in Iraq is reaching out to former officers in Saddam Hussein's army, dismissed from their posts by former American Ambassador Paul Bremer in the early days of the occupation. But first, this news update. With respect, Your Honor, not guilty. With those words, I, Louis Libby, entered his plea while being arraigned in U.S. District Court in Washington today. Libby is charged with five counts, including obstruction of justice, making false statements, and perjury. Afterwards, Libby's lawyer, Ted Wells, had this to say.
Mr. Libby has pled not guilty to each and every count in the indictment. In pleading not guilty, he has declared to the world that he is innocent. He has declared that he intends to fight the charges in the indictment, and he has declared that he wants to clear his good name, and he wants a jury trial.
I'm joined now from Washington by Newsweek's Michael Isikoff, who was at today's arraignment. Mike, when Patrick Fitzgerald announced the changes last week, there was some speculation that there might be a plea bargain in the offing, if only to keep the full story from coming out. But today, it's very clear that we're going to have a jury trial. And are you a little surprised that the administration is willing to have this kind of openness?
Well, I don't think it's the administration. I think it's Scooter Libby, whose liberty is at stake here. And I, as loyal as he is to the White House, he's not a part of the White House right now, and he's fighting for his good name and to stay out of jail. So, no, I'm not surprised. It was, you know, you look at the indictment, it's a reasonably strong case, but it is not a slam dunk, as George Tenet might have said. Yeah, he's hired two top litigators. Ted Wells, who you just played, is a well-known and very successful African-American lawyer that will play, obviously, with a, what is almost certainly going to be a predominantly African-American jury in the District of Columbia. You know, he's going to take his chances.
Now, this leaves us with the prospect that the vice president may actually be called to testify by one side or the other.
On its face, he will be a prosecution witness. Now, it is not clear whether the vice president will show up in the courtroom or whether he will do a videotaped deposition like Ronald Reagan did in the Iran-Contra trials. But, yeah, it's certainly Dick Cheney will be a witness at this case.
Now, the trial isn't going to start immediately, right?
Oh, no. In fact, that was one thing that was clear in today's very brief proceeding. Patrick Fitzgerald said there's voluminous cl- classified material that's part of discovery in this case. Discovery is when the prosecutors have to turn over to the defense what all the evidence they have, including what might be exculpatory evidence. But because so much of it's classified, the first thing that has to happen is all the new defense lawyers in the case have to get security clearances. They have to undergo background checks, and they have to be approved for the receipt of classified information. That in and of itself is going to take some time, I think up to 2 months before up to 2 months before Fitzgerald said he anticipates all the discovery material to be turned over to the defense team once they get their clearances. So we're looking at a status conference in February and a trial that probably won't take place until spring, if not the summer.
And of course, while all this is going on, it will remain a hot topic of discussion at the political front. Louis Libby may not be talking to reporters, but surely Democrats will. Earlier today, just after the arraignment, in fact, Democratic leadership came out, and Dick Durbin of Illinois had this to say about the situation.
We feel that the White House has to be sensitive to the fact that they have an opportunity now to change staffing in this administration, to basically move us forward as a country, and to restore their credibility and leadership.
Credibility and leadership calls vague there, perhaps, for Karl Rove to be replaced and other senior figures in both the vice president's office and in the White House. This is going to have a lot of fallout for the case. It will be difficult, won't it, to perhaps find a jury that doesn't know about this case and be able to hear it properly?
Yeah, although there certainly have been even higher profile cases than this that have gone to trial, Iran-Contra, Watergate in the District of Columbia, Marion Barry, our former mayor who was indicted on drug charges a number of years ago. So it doesn't strike me as off the charts difficult to find a jury.
Michael Isikoff of Newsweek, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure enough.
Mike Isikoff joined us from Washington. He was at today's arraignment of I. Louis Libby. I'll be back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, back with To the Point. After weeks of trial balloons floated and partisans getting first licks in about what should stay and what should go, the House of Representatives Budget Committee got down to work on its version of the federal budget today. The honorable members are looking for savings totaling $50 billion over the next 5 years. The process is called reconciliation, a word that in other contexts has a hopeful connotation, but in the world of federal spending means something a little different and more complex. I'm joined now by Jody Schneider, economics editor of Congressional Quarterly. Hello, Jody.
Hi.
Hi. Could you explain this reconciliation process in layman's terms?
Well, I'll certainly try. Basically, what they are doing is they have adopted a budget amendment. They adopted a budget agreement for fiscal 2006 that allows them to go ahead and, in the Senate, under special rules that allow them to avoid filibusters, can go ahead and cut programs to the tune of mandatory programs to the tune of $32 billion, and then go ahead and pass companion legislation of as much as $70 billion in tax cuts under what we call these special budget reconciliation rules. The Senate is voting today. The House Budget Committee, as you noted, went ahead and approved their package this morning, and they may vote on their budget as soon as next week in the House.
Now, the cuts that are being called for are over a period of 5 years. When we talk about the budget, we're talking about a one-year budget, but with projections for 5 years? This is where it gets confusing.
Right. The cuts we're talking about, the what will amount to, probably when the Senate's done today, $37.5 billion in a budget savings package, those are over 5 years. So frankly, in the long run, with the deficit projected in 5 years to be $1.6 trillion, it doesn't do a whole lot to cut the deficit.
Now, what are some of the programs that have come under scrutiny?
Well, there was a lot of talk early on about the painful cuts that were going to be made to programs like Medicare and Medicaid and food stamps. And there have been some cuts, But what's been particularly interesting lately is that they've also added things. They've gone ahead and actually made $71 billion in budget cuts, a large number, over the 5 years, but they've added back in $32 billion.
What are the add-ins?
Things like Katrina education funding, helping out Katrina victims with getting their school kids educated, doing things, some of it having to do with health care programs, some of the Medicaid, some of the Medicare prescription benefits, things that basically are intended to sweeten the pot, particularly for the GOP moderates who they were afraid they might lose. They might lose their votes. And they need all their votes because no Democrats are expected to vote for the package.
Now, what happens when both houses of Congress have managed to reach their agreements? Then they continue to meet and finalize one budget.
Right. Then they have a conference committee, just as they do on other legislation, and they reconcile their differences. So I guess it's a true reconciliation at that point.
Yeah, well, it's not quite reconciling your checkbook.
Right. Exactly. It's okay. Bigger numbers.
When is this meeting likely to take place?
Well, the problem is the House hasn't gotten its ducks in a row. The Senate is expected to pass their budget reconciliation bill tonight. And the House is expected perhaps as soon as next week to take its to the floor. But the new majority leader in the House, Mr. Blunt, has basically said he, unlike his predecessor, Mr. DeLay, is not going to take things to the floor until he has the votes for them. And right now they don't have the votes in the House. The House has a problem. In the Senate, they were able to largely sweeten the pot for the moderates and give them what they wanted to get their votes. In the House, they have to do that with their moderates, but at the same time, they have a larger problem, which is the House conservatives who want deeper cuts. So they have to balance their moderates against their conservatives, and that's a real challenge.
Jody, thank you very much for joining us. Jody Schneider is economics editor of Congressional Quarterly. Now, in these previous weeks, there's been a lot of talk post-Katrina that the Starve the Beast group, the people that want to trim not just federal spending but just shrink for the federal government, would use this opportunity with the extra spending on Katrina to bring the federal deficit down. I'm joined now by Jim Horney, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which is a nonpartisan fiscal policy research organization based in Washington, D.C. Jim Horney, is the Katrina stuff all a bit of a red herring?
I think it is, and I think that Jody Schneider made a very important point when she noted that the reconciliation process this year is a two-part process, that the first part of the process are these reconciliation bills the House and Senate are considering that would cut mandatory or entitlement program spending. But under the budget resolution adopted last April, that will be followed in both bodies by a bill that will cut, a reconciliation bill that will cut taxes by $70 billion. So one of the little sort of hidden secrets here is that this process will not reduce the deficit. The cuts in the spending bills, that the reconciliation bills, the two bodies are considering, will neither be used to reduce the deficit nor to pay for cost of Katrina, Rita, and Wilma. They will, in fact, be used to only partially offset the tax cuts that will come in the second part of this two-step reconciliation process.
Well, Jim, let's just mention a couple of the specific programs that are likely to be cut in the House.
The House take a very different approach than the Senate. As Jody Schneider said, in the Senate, because of concerns about by moderate Republicans, the chairman of the various committees went to significant lengths to make sure they did not achieve cuts in programs that or in ways that would hurt the beneficiaries of low-income programs. The House took a very different approach. First of all, due to pressure from conservatives in the House, the Republican Study Committee and others, they actually increased the total amount of cuts that they are trying to achieve in this reconciliation.
But in specific programs?
I will say, just I'm saying they increased it. The budget resolution said save $35 billion. They're cutting more than 50. And they did things that the Senate didn't do. For instance, the House Agriculture Committee has proposed a cut of almost $800 million over 5 years in the food stamp program. That would take 300,000 people off the rolls. The Senate Ag Committee didn't have a similar cut. The House Ways and Means Committee cut a number of programs that provide important assistance to low-income people, including a cut of $4.9 billion over 5 years in the Child Support Enforcement Program. And according to the Congressional Budget Office, that reduction in child support enforcement assistance that the federal government provides to states will mean we'll actually collect $7.9 billion less in child support over the next 5 years and $24 billion less over 10 years. Again, the Senate didn't have a similar cut. The House also has cuts in programs like supplemental security income, foster care, and deeper and more harmful cuts in Medicaid.
Jim Horney, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. I'd like to bring into the conversation now Stephen Slavinsky, who's Director of Budget Studies at the Cato Institute, libertarian policy think tank in Washington, D.C. Stephen Slavinsky, I mean, to those who are advocates for social welfare programs, $50 billion of cuts, many of them falling on those entitlement programs, sounds like a lot of money. Do you think it's a lot of money?
I don't think so, especially when you consider that, as Jody had mentioned at the top of the segment, this is a five-year savings plan. Secondly, you have to consider the fact that over that five-year period, federal government's going to be spending multiple trillions. In fact, a mandatory spending alone is going to be at $7.8 trillion spent in the aggregate over those 5 years. And so even $50 billion is a very small drop in the bucket. You've also got to assume that Congress is going to maintain these savings over that five-year period. They could reverse themselves halfway through the way they did, for instance, with the 97 reconciliation bill, which is the last time they've tried something like this. And I think there's one thing the Republicans in Congress have shown is that they have very bad level of commitment when it comes to spending discipline. And so on the one hand, I think some of this might be overblown, especially since the magnitude of these savings are really so small.
But the headline cuts, you know, 300,000 people who receive food stamps, for example, would in all likelihood lose that benefit. You would see that as being a worthwhile cut.
Well, you definitely have a problem with perceptions, at least I think Republicans do, in as much as you can say, first of all, there's two problems going on here. The first is the whole reconciliation process is focused on mandatory spending. So as a result, you're only going to be cutting mandatory programs, and that's where all of these programs for the poor are located. And so not casting a broader net, I think, does hinder the ability of Republicans to get moderate votes on stuff like this, because if they turned around and said, okay, in addition to this, we're also going to be cutting corporate welfare programs, energy subsidies, et cetera, that would probably, I think, win a lot more votes and certainly make conservatives happy even at that point. So I think they're casting too broad a net in terms of, though, the amount of people being taken off, let's say, for instance, as you pointed out, food stamps. Again, in the year 2004, for instance, about 24 million people were on food stamps. And so we're talking about a very small portion, a very small segment. And on top of that, again, the potential for declines in actual food stamp recipients goes up when you consider the fact that that in the future we're probably going to have greater economic growth than we have currently. Food stamp recipients tend to get lower in terms of absolute magnitudes in economic boom periods. And so again, we're dealing with moving targets at this point.
Stephen, let me just stop you because that's a very interesting point, and I'd like to put it back to Jim Horney, that Stephen predicts that economic growth and therefore you'd have fewer people needing food stamps. Is that how you see it?
Well, first of all, I just would point out we've had economic growth now for the last 4 years, and yet we've had an increase in the number of people in poverty. So it doesn't always go together directly. It's certainly clear if we have a long and sustained period of growth that's equally shared by people at all income levels, then we have fewer people in poverty. I also would add that I don't think there's anything in this two-step reconciliation process that will actually lead to higher economic growth than we would have otherwise. I think if we didn't pass the reconciliation bills, we'd actually have lower deficits, and I think economic growth would be at least as high and probably a little higher than if we passed the two reconciliation bills.
Jim Horney, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Stephen Slavinsky, let me just come back to you on that. We do have a duel going here between the two of you, but you I think, would see a much just broader cut across the board. Give us an idea of how far you think budget should be cut to actually have an impact on this mushrooming deficit, $1.6 trillion over the next 5 years.
Well, course, the federal government is spending on an annual basis, you know, around $2.4 trillion. So there's a lot of areas to look at. I think there's two approaches that are being kind of addressed, and you've got different constituencies within Congress hoping for their side to win. The different elements are one considers an across-the-board cut that's been, in a sense, on discretionary spending, meaning the non-entitlement, non-mandatory spending. That's in things like transportation programs, commerce programs, housing programs, and certain types of programs in education, all those sorts of programs, basically non-entitlement programs. The across-the-board cut has been favored by the House leadership. Incidentally, that excludes defense, which strikes me as a big item to take off the table, and they should put it back, but they're not thinking about that. The second idea, or the second element of all of this, is that you've got House conservatives who are thinking about the budget and wondering, okay, across-the-board cuts, that just assumes everything government's currently doing, they should be doing, they just need to be paying less to do it. The assumption would be then that you can go after programs that really shouldn't be in the federal government in the first place. And so one's sort of a,
like
kind of a scalpel approach, the other is kind of across-the-board sort of hacking approach.
What would be a program that doesn't belong in the federal government?
Well, groups like the Republican Study Committee have put forward numerous types of programs.
Just one. Give us an example.
There's a program named the Advanced Technology Program, which underwrites research for, ostensibly they do it for small businesses, but it ends up going to subsidiaries of Fortune 500 companies. You can get rid of various different agriculture subsidies, which also go to big agribusinesses, not the small family farms, as is the conventional wisdom about these things. Those are just two. You've got various sorts of other commerce programs on, you've got energy programs, subsidies to energy companies for research and development on fossil fuels, clean coal, things of that sort. These are things, incidentally, that there is widespread agreement with left and right on, especially the agriculture subsidies and the energy subsidies, that these are things that shouldn't be in the federal government in the first place, and yet the goal would be to try to get rid of those, and that way you're actually freeing up more room in the budget as a result.
Stephen Slavinsky, Director of Budget Studies at the Cato Institute. Jim Horney, let me come back to you for just one quick question. We've been talking mostly about the budget cuts. Could you just propose reasonable numbers on tax cuts? What would work in conjunction with budget cuts, in your view?
I think what would make sense is not to have net tax cuts. There are some things that almost certainly have to be done, like extending at least for 1 year relief from the alternative minimum tax, but they should be paid for, and they could be paid for by been a number of proposals for closing unfair loopholes, tax shelters, and so I think anything that needs to be done, like the AMT relief, should be paid for.
Jim Horney, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. We've been talking, listeners, about today's budget reconciliation process in Washington, cuts coming for sure in certain entitlement programs. What's the price that moderate Republicans might pay at the polls next year when that happens? And later on in our reporter's notebook, we'll be going to Baghdad to hear about the Iraqi government's move to reach out to former officers in Saddam Hussein's army. You're listening to The Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To The Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To The Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To The Point. We've been talking about the budget process in Washington. The budgets are being reconciled in the House and the Senate today. Cuts for sure coming to entitlement programs in both bodies. When you think of tax cutting, you're always thinking in terms of this being almost Republican ideology now, conservative ideology. But there are moderate Republicans, and when you start cutting on the entitlement programs that affect poorer Americans, some of them actually live in Republican districts. I'm joined now by Representative Heather Wilson, who's a Republican congresswoman from New Mexico's 1st District. She represents Albuquerque and its surrounding counties in the House of Representatives. Good morning, Congresswoman.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
Fine. In your district, you would be concerned, I think, about too many cuts in programs like Medicaid.
I am concerned about Medicaid. About 22% of the people in New Mexico rely on Medicaid, and that's one of the highest percentages in the country, although certainly not on the top of the list.
And When you sit down to have discussions with your colleagues in the Republican Party in Congress about cuts, do you get a fair hearing when you start talking about, well, maybe some of these entitlement programs shouldn't be demonized, introduced, and cut dramatically?
Well, I think we need to be clear here about one thing. The Medicaid is not going to be cut. The question is, how quickly will it grow? And even under the budget that the Republicans have proposed, there is over a 7% per year increase over the next 5 years. The real question is, what is included in that? And what can we get Medicaid to better serve the people who depend upon it? And I'm concerned that we're not going in that direction of real reform. And I think that that's what we should do.
And what about the food stamp program? It cuts in the Department of Agriculture budget, means that several hundred thousand people who receive food stamps, many of them legal immigrants, will suddenly lose their eligibility. Because I think one of the things that's being proposed is that now people who've been here legally, I think, for 5 years, correct me if I'm wrong, for 5 years are eligible to receive food stamps. But if it goes to in the proposals, it would be 7 years, and suddenly people would drop off the rolls.
I think that concerns a lot of people. At the same time,
in your district, you have a lot of new Americans in your district.
Well. I have some new Americans. I also have a very long established and very stable district in some respects. But one of the things that hasn't been clear, I don't think, is, and we had this with Medicaid as well, there were some amendments about, you know, not allowing illegal immigrants to have access to social services. That's already the law. My concern is that, for example, with Medicaid, if you say, someone who wants to sign up for Medicaid has to show a passport or a birth certificate or those kinds of things. You know, when you take a kid into foster care because they've been abandoned by their parents, they don't come with a passport. And I'm concerned that those requirements may be a barrier to care for people who are eligible for Medicaid. So I'm concerned about not how this will affect people who aren't eligible and shouldn't be on the rolls in the first place, but how does it affect people who are eligible? And barriers to care are real.
Now, you have to be especially sensitive to electoral concerns because you're only a year out from an election campaign. How do these discussions play with your constituents? I mean, do you find yourself getting mail from people? Are you aware that people are concerned that things that they have come to expect from the federal government might be taken away and therefore they might vote for your Democratic opponent?
For me, that's not an issue. I used to run the child welfare system in New Mexico, so I come at this from the perspective of a parent, of somebody who's familiar with the foster care system, who's tried to provide services for children who are mentally ill, who are abused and neglected. And so my perspective is always do the right thing for the people you serve, and everything else will take care of itself. So I'm not voting for this and didn't support it as it came out of the Energy and Commerce Committee because it exceeded the amount of savings that were agreed to with the Senate, and I really don't think that our approach serves the people I came here to represent. And that's just
okay. Well,
not a surprise, I don't think.
Leaving your local analysis aside, what about the national prospects for the Republican Party? When people look at tax cuts and all the pledges made by the president, and then the price for tax cuts and all the pledges for Reconstruction, continuing the conflict in Iraq, supporting the troops there, it comes out of local programs. Do you think that that's actually going to hurt national prospects for the GOP?
I think people want to be reassured that their government is going to get $1.10 of value out of every dollar that we spend, and that we are going to get back to a balanced budget, and probably the most underreported story of this year is that we reduced the deficit by $100 billion. And that was done by policies that continue economic growth while we control the growth of spending. The question for this week is, where do we go from here? And I have some problems with what's in this next piece of legislation on the budget, particularly as it affects Medicaid and the constituents I represent. But I don't think there's any question that we've done a pretty good job thus far in getting back towards balanced budgets And we balanced the budget for the first 4 years I was in Congress, and that was the first time it was done since 1969.
Yes, but you've been in Congress more than 4 years. So in recent years, it hasn't been happening.
Yes. We were, the week before 9/11 in the Congress, we were debating what to do with a $300 billion surplus. And then the world changed. I think you take into account what has happened. You deal with a national emergency, with a war on terror, with a slow economy, and then turn the corner and get back towards balanced budgets. And I think that's happening. Certainly is happening this year with a 25% reduction in the deficit in 12 months.
These numbers come out and they fly around. Our earlier guest, Stephen Slavinsky, was pointing out that these cuts represent very, very little in the $1.6 trillion total. You would probably have to make more significant cuts if you were really going to attack this deficit, wouldn't you?
For me, the question is set aside and is to reform Medicaid without respect to, we've got to come up with such and such a number by such and such a date. And that was, I think that policy should drive the budget and not the other way around. I think Medicaid doesn't serve the people who depend upon it, and that we should focus on improving the health status of low-income Americans. There are now 2,500 waivers to this system. Any system that needs that many exceptions to the rule to operate needs to have some changes to the rules.
Hopefully in the future we'll be talking more about reforming programs without.
But this bill does not accomplish those.
I understand that. The Congress should be discussing reforming existing programs rather than just killing them off. Representative Heather Wilson, Republican Congresswoman from New Mexico's 1st District, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'd like to bring into the discussion now Carol Dougherty, who's the Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, an independent public opinion research organization based in Washington. Carol Dougherty, there isn't a great deal of consensus in Congress about how to cut the budget, and the numbers vary from people to people, and I think most of us kind of get fuzzed out by all the numbers. How does the public see all this discussion about budget cutting?
Well, there's not much of a consensus in the public either. I mean, that's probably what you're seeing reflected in Congress at this point. The old days in the 90s when Ross Perot was around and talking about the deficit, the world's changed a lot since then. Deficit's a concern, not as much as it was back in the mid-90s. And when you ask people, how to pay for Katrina or how to cut the deficit, they don't really want to give up things like Medicare drug benefits. They don't want to raise taxes particularly. They don't want to even cut highway spending. The preferred option is cut spending for the war in Iraq, but that's obviously not going to happen.
Nor would it be enough. If you list all of the things that the federal government contributes to, just in terms of national infrastructure, this comes to a point of like a national schizophrenia about this. Everybody wants their personal taxes cut, but nobody wants their public services cut.
Exactly. I think what you're seeing here is that is it the desire for smaller government? It was pretty apparent that the Republicans were running on this in the 90s. It helped them get the majority, but it's a little more complicated when you get into power. And a lot of people out there, even a lot of Republicans, like government and like what it does for them.
Well, the vote in Colorado the other day was an interesting one. This was a proposition about capping taxes at a very, very low level. And it was not supported by the electorate in Colorado. Is that an indication that perhaps people are beginning to understand that you need government just to provide basic infrastructure, if nothing else, and that it's all been cut too far in the last couple of years anyway?
I think that's true, but I think there's a difference between cutting taxes more and raising taxes. I think the public also would be averse to any suggestions on raising taxes to, say, pay for Katrina or pay for Iraq. That would be a non-starter. No more tax cuts, though, I think would be a more solid position in terms of where the public is right now.
One of the aspects of today's discussions in the Senate is there's going to be is the drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. in which this is another thing in which Americans don't want, you know, they don't want their taxes raised, but they want their government services, and they don't want the environment despoiled. But, you know, Republicans would say that if we drill for oil, we can at least, you know, have more energy independence, and, you know, this may take gasoline prices back down. In your polling, do you ever poll on these other aspects of Americans' relationship to paying for their government? Is the environment a big deal for people?
It's a second tier issue, but an important one nonetheless. And as far as the Alaska drilling goes, I mean, the high price of gas over the summer had an effect on attitudes towards the Alaska drilling. And there was a little bit more support. We went from 42% in favor of that drilling in March to 50% in September. And, you know, that's modest, but still indicative. The direction's very interesting. I think people generally in that September poll said the environment's important, but we need more energy production to deal with these high gas prices.
Heather Wilson was talking earlier about her district in Albuquerque. Now, that is, in terms of its demographics, probably slightly more a Democratic district, and she's a Republican. She's going to face a strong challenge from the Attorney General there, a Democrat who's serving as Attorney General now. I just wonder, do you think that the Republican Party is in trouble if the budget cuts are too deep, that it might actually affect the 2006 vote and that they may lose seats in the House of Representatives because of this?
I think they're in a difficult position on that. I think what's misunderstood about the Republican majority to some degree is the extent to which some moderates and people who don't run in traditionally Republican or conservative districts are part of that coalition now. I mean, one of the interesting things we saw, we did a major study of the electorate earlier this year, and we found Republicans have a bigger tent now than they used to, but that some of the people who are brought under these tent are not what you'd call classic conservatives. These are people who believe in government again. These are people who say the government should do more to help needy Americans. They agree with the Republicans on a lot of social issues, but when it comes to more government aid to the poor specifically, they support that. And so I think that's the Republicans are sort of facing difficulties created by their own success.
What do you reckon the key issues will be then by the time we get to the midterm elections in 12 months?
Well, I think obviously President Bush and his performance and Iraq, I think, though, and, you know, depending on how the economy goes, the economy's been perking up, although it isn't reflected in the public views of the economy. They're still pretty down on the economy. But those are going to be the major issues, and I think it's instructive that you already see some candidates around the country who are unwilling to appear with the president, and it shows that at 35% approval ratings, he's a bit of a liability at this point.
In the American mind, this is a question. I live overseas. I live in London, and one of the things that has seemed to happen during this administration is there's been an extraordinary top-down sense of discipline in the Republican Party, and that you couldn't break out the executive, the president, from the leadership on Capitol Hill. Is that changing? And are people going to be able to make a distinction between their local representatives and the national leadership?
Well, I think that will be the goal of a lot of those local representatives, to say that I've served you and that I'm on the ballot, not the president. I think a lot of that discipline has broken down in recent months, as we've seen. In part, this happens to a lot of second-term presidents, but it's in part also because of the troubled summer that President Bush has had, and, you know, in the wake of Katrina and with the mounting death toll in Iraq.
Carol Doherty, thanks very much for joining us. Carol Doherty is the Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for the People in the Press, an independent public opinion research organization based in Washington. We were also joined by Representative Heather Wilson, Republican Congresswoman from New Mexico's 1st District. She represents Albuquerque and its surrounding counties. Stephen Slavinsky, Director of Budget Studies at the Cato Institute, a libertarian policy think tank in Washington, D.C., and Jim Horney, Senior Fellow, Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Jody Schneider, economics editor for Congressional Quarterly. Coming up on Reporter's Notebook, in Baghdad, the Iraqi government invites former officers in the Iraqi army to rejoin the security forces. Can this move help in the fight against the insurgency? This is To the Point from PRI.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. When American Ambassador Paul Bremer was put in charge of the American occupation of Iraq back in May 2003, one of the first things he did was disband the Iraqi army. Most analysts in Washington and Baghdad say it was one of the great mistakes of the post-war period. Yesterday, the Iraqi government reached out to some of the officers dismissed and urged them to rejoin the new Iraqi army. To tell us more, I'm joined on a line from Vermont by William Arkin, who is the military affairs analyst for NBC and a Washington Post online columnist. Hello, Bill.
Hey, how are you today?
Fine. Now, this move to bring back mid-level officers in the old Iraqi army, Saddam's army, was this unexpected?
Well, I'm not sure it's unexpected. The United States has been trying to figure out a way of, walking back its decisions to disband the army and blacklist anyone who was associated with the Ba'ath Party and Saddam's government. The Iraqi interim government itself recognizes that it needs to attract more officers, and these low-level officers are at least considered to be less politically stained than people at higher levels.
What is it that the Iraqi government would hope to achieve by bringing in these mid-level officers? I believe it's up to the rank of major have been invited to join in.
Well, this is a big unknown. I mean, what is it exactly that we're buying here? what are these officers worth? I wouldn't have said to you prior to today that the Iraqi army ever displayed itself as being technically proficient, militarily savvy, particularly a good military force. So reaching into the former officer corps in order to man the current Iraqi army, to me, is not certainly a solution that smacks of some kind of tactical excellence. It sounds to me like it's more a political act to try to make amends with Sunnis who were previously officers within Saddam's army, as well as with a large group of underemployed and unemployed Iraqi men, which is there is a desire to capture them as part of the system.
You were saying walking back from American policy. Do you think that this kind of move is done independently by this interim government, or do you think it was approved by Zalmay Khalilzad, who's the president's representative there at the moment?
Well, we wouldn't want to say that the U.S. ambassador approves anything that the Iraqi interim government does, but clearly there is a desire on the part of the current government in Baghdad to figure out ways of making amends with both the Sunni tribes as well as with former workers within the Saddam Hussein regime. I think that this is an independent move. The Iraqis are obviously struggling to build up both their national police force and their army. I think that the danger here is believing that just because this recruitment drive has been extended, somehow that this is going to equal an acceleration of skills on the part of the Iraqi army or their ability to assume the security responsibilities.
But there's another thing as well, which is the insurgency, is the number of insurgents, it's hard to guess how many are in the country who are foreign and how many Iraqis themselves are active participants in the insurgency. But it always seems that a fair amount of the, social infrastructure that allows this kind of insurgency to thrive comes, the protections come from people who feel that they've been cast out of the new Iraq. And among them surely have to be some of these mid-level army officers who would provide, not necessarily logistical help, but, just the kinds of sympathies that allow an insurgency to flourish.
I think that Iraqi society has become ever more polarized since the 2003 war, a first polarized much more than it was previously between Shia and Sunni, and now I think polarized much more between those who are supporters of the government and those who are supporters of the insurgency. We do have an understanding, basically, of the degree to which Iraqis are behind what's going on in Iraq. I think the number of foreign fighters is overstated, and the significance of foreign fighters in the insurgency is also low. So we are talking here about a political attempt to fold in an ever greater number of Iraqis into the system, whether that be in police or in the armed forces or in government. And Iraq as a society is one that is not going to be quick to change. And my guess is there's a little bit of implicit bribery associated here in the sense that there's an attempt on the part of the government in Baghdad to pay off those who might be attracted to the insurgency, and that they're literally buying their loyalty to a new Iraqi state.
Well, that's not an unknown practice of politics in Iraq, going back to even before the Ba'ath Party.
Completely, and I think that this level of sort of, let's say, financial transactions, which we are already observing occurring between Baghdad and the various tribes, between Baghdad and other militias, between Baghdad and religious and political leaders who are not a part of the government, I think now we're maybe seeing an attempt as well to try to capture a fairly large group of Ba'ath Party functionaries, Ba'ath Party low-level people, because, of course, no one was a significant officer in the Iraqi army under Saddam Hussein unless they were a Ba'ath Party member or candidate. And so we are witnessing an attempt to try to make amends with that former government. Whether that will be successful in diffusing or deflating the insurgency, or whether that will not result in what we saw in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, which is an influx of spies into the Iraqi army who essentially are reporting back to the insurgency, is a huge question.
We've already seen that, certainly in the police forces. I mean, it's not clear to whom the police forces around the country have loyalty. I mean, the state doesn't seem to inspire much loyalty amongst its security forces, and people are loyal to local leaderships, and this is why we have, in some places, you know, they wear Iraqi police service uniforms, but they're essentially local militias.
Well, I think loyalty is one question, Michael. The other question is just straight-out espionage and split lives. Here, I think, look, there's no question that Iraqi military and police are faced with a task today that they were never faced with under Saddam Hussein. I remember visiting Iraq a number of times during the 1990s under Saddam. It was probably one of the safest places in the world to go. That's what happens in an autocratic regime. And now the military and the security forces and the army are being faced with something which they've never before had to face. Whether their loyalties are split between the Baghdad government and local militias or the tribes of which they are members is a secondary question to whether or not the influx of new officers into the Iraqi army is going to bring in infiltrators who are going to explicitly undermine the operations of the Iraqi army. At a time when we are trying to turn over more and more of the responsibility for Iraqi security to this force, this is a very dangerous possibility.
I suppose the test will be the first time significant numbers of these officers lead men on operations in conjunction with the U.S. against insurgents. I mean, when for example, in Tal Afar, where there's been ongoing operations in the north of Iraq, when the leadership in those operations against insurgents is led by Iraqi soldiers who are led by men who've come in recently from the cold, taken up the offer from the interim Iraqi government. And until that moment, we won't be able to know for sure where the loyalties of these men lie.
Well, again, loyalty is a funny question. They are probably Iraqis first, and most Iraqis that I know my reading of Iraqi society and culture today says that their absolute number one priority is getting the American military out of the country. And so how you see Iraqis' loyalty with that being their primary desire and objective, I think when we watch these operations in places like Tal Afar and in Ramadi and Fallujah and Baqaba, where you have the major concentration.
Bill, I'm sorry, we're coming to the end of the program, and I'm going to have to stop you there. But I want to thank you for joining us. William Arkin is the military affairs analyst for NBC and Washington Post online columnist, and his blog can be found at blog.washingtonpost.com/early warning. Today's program was produced by Jonah King with Katie Cooper and Ileana Justice. The technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Michael Goldfarb. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.